Wexler at the NYU Library beginning an interview for the Crown Heights History Project with Avraham Crawford. Introducing Avraham Crawford, we're at the NYU Library with an oral history for the Crown Heights History Project.
Before we get started in our narrative,
so 27 years full time.
And what is your wife's name?
Sarah.
And would that be Sarah?
Sarah in English. S-A-R-A-H.
Surrey.
She calls S-U-R-I, Surrey.
And where is she from?
She was born in Brooklyn also, but she grew up in Massachusetts in Holyoke.
Oh, it's funny, I'm working with
her. She was born at what's now Brookdale, was Beth Israel at that time. Mm-hmm. She was born there.
And where?
54, I think.
Where was she educated?
She went to school up there, and then she learned 2 years in Israel. She never finished college up there. She started college. I think she has maybe like 2 years of college credit. University of Massachusetts, probably somewhere.
Right, Amherst. Where in Israel did she study?
She studied in the Beit Yerushalayim.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. She was there. She came back for her sister's wedding, then she went back for another year, so she was 2 years over there. Shortly after she came back for the second year, from the second year she got married.
And I've met Nahami on the phone.
Uh-huh.
She's 15?
She's 16 now. She'll be 17 in November.
And how many other children do you have?
Two boys.
What are their names? Yoel?
Yisrael, he'll be 11 in another couple of weeks, about 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now.
And
Yitzchak. Yitzchak is 15, he'll be 16 in February.
Great. Were you brought up speaking English at home?
Yes. My parents were from Newfoundland. They were both from Newfoundland.
Uh-huh. And where had they immigrated from?
Well, they both came in from Newfoundland. My mother came in as her father was an American citizen. He used to work on fishing boats and moved to go in New Bedford, between St. John's is a Newfoundland's a famous fishing. That's the big industry up there. Salt codfish was the main export product from the family for hundreds of years.
How did they happen to move to Brooklyn?
My mother came, I think she first came into Boston. She was up in Boston for a while. I think she was with an army family. She She worked at what's now the Crown Heights Hotel, and that was Peck Memorial Hospital. Her first job here in New York, there she came in 19, she worked there in 1940, the summer of 1940.
Where's the Crown Heights Hotel?
That big, between, on Albany, between Albany and Troy Avenues,
yes.
And between Carroll and Crown Streets.
Mm-hmm, sure.
A big, it was a hospital, it takes up a whole square block. Well, now there's a high school, now there's a school on one end of it, but before it was a, it occupied a whole square city block. The main building and the outproperties, the residences and stuff.
She was with her family, or she was already married then?
No, she married in 42. No, she came, her and her sister came here. They were domestic help. She said when she first started working in Newfoundland, she used to make $5 a month. Plus room and board, that was like from 6 o'clock in the morning to 10 o'clock in the night. Mm-hmm. And for that money, from $5 a month, she sent out money to her mother, really, desperate. She came from a family of eight. And it was another depression, of course. They didn't have no industry. They were fishing. And they raised, they were part of their own crops. They raised some potatoes and cabbages and stuff like that.
Pretty brutal winter.
Yeah. Oh, it's extremely cold. Basically, right out of the middle of North Atlantic.
Were you brought up Jewish?
No. My family's Irish Catholic.
Irish Catholic.
I converted. I came here to Crown Heights. And I was converted by Lubavitch. I was converted by Rabbi Jacobson. He was one of the senior Lubavitch rabbis, like the last generation.
Is he any relation to Simon Jacobson?
I don't think it's the same. It's possible they may be cousins or something. I'm not sure. I don't think so.
Well,
the one about Gershon Jacobson, the one who published the Allgemeine, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't. It's possible that maybe. I don't think that.
How did you first hear about Lubavitcher Hasidim or Judaism?
Well, I mean, I was learning here at NYU, and I was always very interested in religion. I always said I was going to become a priest.
Uh-huh.
And I had taken Latin and Greek, and I was like learning Greek New Testament, and then I started learning Hebrew, like to get some idea of the background. And the more I investigated Christianity, the more I found it wasn't, it didn't strike me as... But in philosophy, my main interest was logic. I wanted to see if you could set up a rational scheme, like to, Christianity should be able to, prove itself in some way or other as a valid, coherent system. And the more there were great difficulties with Christian, more so than with Judaism. I mean, Judaism, if you accept revelation and historical continuity of a people, then you... It goes through pretty smoothly, but Christianity has grave difficulties with all kinds of people. I mean, it's a much more, it imposes a much greater mind load, question begging. It starts off with, premises are much more tenuous, much more shaky. You have to put it, if you're prepared to accept sort of like a Gnostic position that the world is intrinsically evil and can only be redeemed, it starts off much, much more dubious grounds, support. It asks you to suspend belief at a much earlier point, suspend disbelief at a much earlier point.
Could you, this is a tough question, but could you maybe sum up a sentence which you think is the point of departure for Jewish thinking?
Well, I mean, it says like Judaism starts off like, I mean, the opening doesn't demand, it says like, the world, the earth is the Lord's. I mean, it's in the opening sentence of Genesis, God created heaven and earth in the beginning. It's a given that there exists an all-powerful, supreme being who has... who made the world out of nothing. And at some point in history, he chose to reveal himself to man and to call certain people to follow him. And they've been following him ever since.
So your first entree to Judaism was more...
Well, it was in questioning Christianity. I mean, obviously, Christianity claims to be the fulfillment or the successor to Judaism. But I mean, it stands in contradiction at so many points. Like, if you do this, really doesn't it really doesn't properly claim this this title.
Were you brought up with a catechism?
Oh yeah, sure. We went to all Catholic grammar schools, and we were a very religious family. I was an altar boy. And we had my father had a sister, a nun. We were very active in the church. I worked in the church for many years.
During those years of learning your Catholic culture, were you questioning it?
As soon as I got old enough to, as soon as I had a similar, I was always learning. There was always like investigating things. When I was an altar boy, we had to memorize things. But I insisted on learning enough Latin to be able to, investigate inside, like what was being said and things like that. I learned Latin fairly fluently when I was still in grammar school. Not enough to speak it, but enough to read it easily.
What part of Brooklyn were you in then?
Sunset Park, right underneath Borough, like 5th Avenue and 43rd Street.
Which is now much more Latino.
Yes, right. Yeah.
So was there any social or commercial contact with Jews?
We lived right next door. Before we moved into my parents' bought a house. The last house they had was near 5th Avenue. And they bought that at 55. We moved in there. But before that, we lived down below 4th Avenue, between 4th and 3rd. And we lived next door to an Orthodox Jewish. There was an old couple. He did ornamental ironwork. He had a shop out in the back. They made like cellar doors and things like that. And they were over there from the 70s, and the children were, grown and raised. And she didn't speak English very well, so she would ask my mother to translate, but to read her a letter. The children would write to her in English. And then she only read it with difficulty. She would ask my mother to read it for her. But my mother and her became friends. We have much less contact with the man, but we knew him to say hello to him. But her and my mother became friends as well as over the back fence, I wouldn't say we really learned anything specific from them, but we saw they would light the Shabbos candles on Friday night. It was a synagogue on 4th Avenue and 53rd or 54th. Apparently, at one time, it must have been a fairly large congregation because they had a building, a regular synagogue that they had sold quite some time before that to the Seventh-day Adventists, and they kept a community center next to it. I presume they had this synagogue on the first floor. But after a while, that was sold also. I haven't been back there to check out things, but I know it was sold several years ago, the community center. Apparently, whatever congregation there was, it dispersed. But there were still several shopkeepers around, candy store owners, and mostly along 5th Avenue, but a few on 4th Avenue also. They were closed for that. I remember them being closed for the holidays, like Passover or Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur. They were closed, and we got to get the newspapers, and we had to look around because all the shops in the immediate vicinity were closed. So we had to go several blocks away to find the New York Times or something like that.
So, there weren't any Jewish kids in your school because it was a Catholic school.
It was a Catholic school, no.
Right.
There was another family. It was a family, when I was very young, it was a family called Leader, he was an insurance broker, I guess. And they lived in the neighborhood. They were Jewish. I don't remember them very well, but I don't think they were observant, but they were Jewish. And they lived, I think his office being there for a while, but I think the family moved out after we got together. They bought a house somewhere outside that neighborhood.
As you became more interested in Judaism as a philosophical approach or perhaps a religious system that answered questions mm-hmm. better, how were you introduced to Hasidim and specifically?
When I started investigating it, the first thing, I went into Borough Park we were doing some Christmas shopping. I think it was 65, I think it was, as far as I can remember. December for 65, we're doing some Christmas up in Borough Park. We knew there was a shopping area, so we occasionally go up there. It was within like walking distance, you know, 10 or 15 minute walk from Fifth Avenue. It was like up the hill. Once you got up the hill, you just went down to the other side, and you eventually ended up in Borough Park. So we occasionally walk up there. I picked up a code of Jewish law. This kid's a Shulman Aruch in English. And, you know, it opened my eyes. Like, starts off and says, I have set the Lord always before me. This is like the guiding principle, you know, that, you know, as soon as one realizes that, you know, as I say, I've been learning Hebrew before that, and I picked up a Kumish, and I started, learning more and more about it, and I checked with, like, the RCA, which is, like, Rabbinic
Council.
They're hooked up with the OU, they're associated with the Orthodox.
Orthodox Union.
Yeah, right. So one of the rabbis from that had written an article in the magazine the OU used to publish, they still made, called Jewish Life. It was a small little, like, bi-monthly, I think. And they had an article in there something about conversion. It's like, and this was written by Melek Schachter, who was the Olive Beis Din. He was the head of the Beis Din. The court of law court. He was the head of that. I don't think he was head at that time, but he had previously been head before. And he was an expert on conversions. This is one. So I went up to see him once, and he said, what do you need to, what do you? So anyway, he gave me a.
He discouraged you.
They're supposed to not take people. I mean, it's not such something you enter into casually. And you're supposed to discourage people, unless you're prepared to, follow through on this, and it's not just something to undertake lightly. Conversion is not like buying a new suit or something like that. It's a very serious,
commitment.
Yeah. So he gave me the names of some people in Borough Park, some rabbis I could speak to over there. So I went to see one of them. Israel Shore. He was the head of the Young Israel of Borough Park. I think that time it was called Temple something. They took over a conservative.
It's a modern Orthodox.
Young Israel is modern Orthodox, but there's like a spectrum. There are people in it who are more Orthodox than So anyway, he was just on his way out to something, but he sat down and spoke to me while we talked for an hour or so. And he, said, keep learning, and get back to me, and we'll see. We'll see. And
you were learning on your own.
Yeah.
What were you reading?
Everything I could lay my hand. I read voraciously. I read everything,
At that time, you were working here at the library.
Yeah. And I graduated in June of '66. I got my bachelor's degree. I was doing graduate studies. Philosophy, mostly in logic and things, and meanwhile I was, investigating. So anyway, I called. I saw someone's name in the paper as who was it? He was a specialist on Gittin, on Jewish divorces, and it was, the rest of it, an article that he was like a prominent jurist or something like that. So I gave him a call. And he said, I have no time for such things. Just speak to a friend of mine. He said, speak to Rabbi Hecht, J.J. Hecht. And I spoke to J.J. Hecht. And he said, I went out to see him. I spoke to him over the phone for quite a while. He said, I'd like you to go to a teacher of mine. So conversion is something that even most like practicing rabbis, they defer to someone more senior because it's a very tricky, touchy thing. So he said, I want you to go to see my old teachers. I went to see Rabbi Jacobson. Rabbi Jacobson was one of the senior rabbis of Lubavitch. And he had a heart attack a while before. I went to see him in his Hanukkah of 1968. I went to see him at his house, and he was like sort of frail. And they said before he had this heart attack, he could like move.
I've heard stories about it.
Rabbi Jacobson, the Friedrich Rebbe, over the show, left him in this country. 1929, when he came here, he was one. He says, "But I want to get back to Russia." He says, "In Russia, I have many people to I can rely on." He says, "I want someone here who I can trust." And he was one of the founders of Bais Rivka, and he was like just. They said he would do any. He would literally move mountains. They said.
What was his first name?
Israel Jacobs. Great, great man. And I went to see him, and he said, like, better you should be a good Christian. And because he said, you must understand what you're undertaking. He said, you know, all this learning and stuff like that. And we sat and we talked for a while, and he said, continue your learning and, you know, get back to me. And just about that time, my mother had cancer of the uterus. And she was in the hospital for quite a while, and then she came out. So I stayed home, and I was home in about another 2 years. Before I came back, it was December of 68. That's when I found December of 68? Yeah, 69, I guess. And that was 67, she was sick. 67, she had the operation in February 67, I think. And it was about more than 2 years before I finally came back. I came back, and they had a college weekend for college students here. And I saw it in the paper, advertised one of the Jewish press or something like that. So I sent in, I came here for a weekend. And then, like, the last day
of Crown Heights.
I stayed with a family, Carp. Bruce Carp, he's a social worker, he's here for OHEL. He was like one of the first Balchuvas, like, to marry. He married Lipska, which was a prominent family. He's a cousin of theirs. Her father was like the chief purchasing agent for the Lubavitch Yeshivas. He used to buy all the food and everything like that for the Mikoyal Lipska. He was so he married Lipska's daughter, which at that time was considered like very strange thing. But apparently he spoke Russian, and this guy, he wasn't Russian. I think he had taken Russian at school, like as an undergraduate. So, and of course, they were all from Russia, the old Lubavitches were all
Russian.
Yeah. So I stayed by them, and then I spoke to Rabbi Jacobson after that, and he helped me find an apartment in Crown Heights. I moved in here day before Pesach in 1970, and then I was converted the day before Shavuos in 1970.
This was
Shin Lamed.
Right. What do you think Rabbi Jacobson picked up in you?
I think the main thing was sincere. You know, I think that he said, you know, it says the rabbi has to try. I mean, that you for the actual conversion you need three people, but just the last two I only met at, you know, that. At one time, he got two other rabbis. One was also did the circumcision, and one was Rabbi Simpson, who lives out in Brighton Beach, has a congregation in Brighton Beach. He works in the office. He's also in the secretariat. But they were the other two. But he, I mean, as the one who, like, actually, the main thing is, he said, you know, you have to know, like, that this is a lifetime commitment. It's not something to be lightly undertaken. And, you know, you have to realize what you're getting yourself in for, and be prepared to accept attendant obligations and everything like that. This is, you know, if you're committed to it, then we will go through with it. But you have to realize what you're undertaking.
Two things occur to me simultaneously, but one is that I'd like to know about. Was there any test? Did they question you?
Well, they question. It says like just the person should be taught, like instructed, or some of the items. What to say? Lighter and the heavier, like the Sabbath and kashrus.
Customs.
Not just customs. I mean the Sabbath is not just the custom. The Sabbath is the penalties for transgressing the Sabbath. It's kind of court. It's law. You're either. It's liable to death at the hands of, you know, either here in this world or, you know, it's not something. You have to realize, it's like you have to tell the person, yesterday you could eat pork and we would incur no punishment. It's not forbidden to you. But now it is. And you have to, it's a lifetime of, and of course they want to make sure, he said, you're not undertaking this for the purposes of marriage or, I wasn't seeing anyone because I didn't want to, entangle anyone else until I got my personal, status in order. I didn't want to. But if you were doing it for the purposes of marriage or something like that, then that casts a whole new, then there's an ulterior motive, why you're, He said if you're doing this out of a firm religious conviction that this is the truth, and this is the way you want to conduct your life. This is the end.
Were you nervous?
No. I mean, my mother said, I hope you know what you're doing. She said, it sounds interesting, but I was raised this way, and I'm 60 years old, and I'm not about to change now.
What were other observations or feelings from members of your?
Well, I mean, I talked it over with priests and stuff like that, and they all said, essentially it's a matter of belief. I mean, those who can accept, Christianity is like sort of one of these horse capsules. If you swallow the whole thing, and without pausing, it goes down. But as soon as you, as soon as you gag on it, it all comes apart. Like it's a much shakier superstructure. I mean, the best part is its foundation in Judaism, but the metaphysics, the metaphysical superstructure is much more shaky.
Do you think it's?
I think it's. I mean, I don't think you really need. I mean, I don't think it adds anything. I don't think you get anything that you don't have in Judaism already, without picking up all this additional, baggage. I don't see what Christianity gives you that you don't already have in Judaism.
How did you mesh, for example, what you had been taught in Catholicism about the Messiah?
Well, I mean, I think it becomes. I think one of the main reasons it becomes obvious that Jesus, whatever he was, he wasn't the Messiah. At that time, there may have been reasons for thinking he was, but it's become. I think that all the problems that Christianity has had and is having now are an effort to push off this realization that he wasn't the Messiah. His followers at that time thought he was, but I mean, I think historically it demonstrated that he wasn't. Whatever he was, a teacher or a wonder worker or something like that, he wasn't in his life.
Does your upbringing as a Christian give you special insight into understanding aspects of Christian anti-Semitism?
I think one of the main roots is envy that the Jews have an alternative model, which they, which is equally, Christianity has to concede the validity of Judaism, and Judaism, of course, does not concede the validity of Christianity. In fact, Christianity, the claims to be, but as I said, the claim is, without merit.
Well, we don't. Jews don't deny, for example, aspects of miraculous events that happen.
But we
don't individualize them into a human
who. Well, I mean.
Such as canonization.
No, we don't. No. We don't deny that miracles can occur. But we say this. I mean, they don't support the claims that are made for them. I'm sure there are, pious individuals within the Christian community who, that miracles probably have been wrought on their behalf. But, Now, that doesn't justify, like, it says, you know, like, a Kabbalist will really have a vision of the Virgin Mary. It's just as Chopin is modeled, if he sees anything, when he dreams, you know, the spheres or something like that, he conceptualizes things differently. He's not it's like a template. The way you, if your template is open only at the letter R, then you see things R shaped.
Exactly.
And someone who has an S shaped template will see things, you know.
Exactly. That's a great metaphor, actually.
Right, it's like these polarized lenses, like, you know, the if you turn them around, you see, you know, you blot out the Roni
shapes.
It works only in one, horizontally or vertically, but not both ways, and you can cut out the whole spectrum by turning it 90 degrees. In logic, they have the alternative models. There's a famous theorem called the Löwenheim-Skolem theorem, which says that if a theory needs an infinite set to satisfy it, it can be satisfied by a finite collection. Under a suitable transformation, you can pack the infinite into the finite, which means everything is true under interpretation. There exists a model which makes every statement true. So, I mean, like when someone mugs an old lady and steals her purse, he justifies this by setting his scheme of values in opposition to hers. And the same way when the judge sentences him, and the jury and stuff like that, they're all, his lawyer will defend him using one model, and the prosecutor will prosecute him using another model, and they will assign different values to the variables. And the way we perceive the world, everyone perceives the world in a model. They make a structure, and the values you assign to the variables determine the way the world. So the Christians have a different model of the world, and the way that the world is in need of, the world is damned, not damned, but is cursed, whatever. They have a certain vision of the world that their model satisfies. And Judaism has a different, like the optimist and pessimist. Like they have painted themselves into what I like to call the Gnostic corner. The Gnostic corner says the world, the soul is estranged or whatever like that, and it can only be redeemed by like a ray from above. We say no, the world is intrinsically good, it's made by a holy God, and it's we who redeem the world. It says don't read, I will take you out from exile, but you will take me out of exile. This is the great secret. Not that God went down and took. It says, you know, I will go down into Egypt with you, and I will surely bring you back. And it says, not I will bring you back, but you will bring me back. You will take me out of Egypt.
So it creates this continual
dialogue. Man not only saves himself, but he saves God also. That he literally, the world is waiting to be. It is we who redeem. Essentially, the redemption, the creation was started by God and is like renewed every minute. But man's role is essentially to complete the task. And this is the finishing touches on it. We are sent here specifically to do this mission, to lift up the whole world to God. This is it. This is you will sanctify me. This is what sanctification means. This is the essential difference. Christianity and Judaism. Judaism sees the world as perfectible, and we are the ones who do the finishing. Like it's like someone buys a new car and he makes it his by, you know. This is the whole essential difference.
And what do Christians
think? Christians are waiting for salvation from outside. This is it. They think that that they will be. Salvation comes from outside. It really doesn't.
What is the contrast, what is the meaning of grace in a Christian context, when you receive grace or you're filled with grace?
Yeah, saving, this is like sort of a...
Is there a Jewish analogy to that?
Well, I mean, it says that man's, everything that person does is determined from above. It says everything is determined, yet free will is given. That.
What is that?
Well...
Everything
is determined that it
is
free will is given. You see, because you don't know what the determination is. When you When you stand at a crossroads, I mean, it's like it was known, I mean, which way you will go, but you don't know that this is, you know, you don't know. You still have to make the determination. It's still in your, it says when someone goes to sin, all the gates of uncleanliness open up before him. And if he chooses the right path, it's like you go down a narrow road, and eventually, as soon as you start, when you start into it, you can turn around easily. But the further down the road you go, the more difficult it becomes to extricate yourself from this. I mean, finally you find yourself at a point where there are no options. When you begin, there are many options. The further down you go, though, you lock yourself into a...
And that's a Christian.
That's a Christian. That's a Christian point of view. I mean,
but how does that compare, Avram, with the prayers of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, in which this will happen to you in the next year, but by prayer, repentance...
We can. It says that one has to pray. One should pray that what hash, you know, what you should be like, you should become like a vehicle for godliness. It says that man's task is to be like a vessel, and the holier, I mean, the more he attunes himself, someone who's on a, says like someone who looks in his purse and one worries about tomorrow is like someone who says there's no God. That he, someone who is completely, relies completely on God, God takes care of his every need. And those, the more one attaches oneself to material things, the more, I mean, everything can be utilized for holiness, but the more we use them only for material things, then we're, become, it's a, I was to say that this is my, it says someone who, we're messengers of the king. When we go about the king's business, then we travel on the king's expense account, and the king picks, and we go by the king's highway, and the king is responsible for all our, but as soon as we say, oh, I'm going to do my own thing, then obviously we can't charge the king for these expenses, and we have to go by other roads. We can't use the king's highway, because we're not. And someone who conducts himself properly, he will find things go very smoothly, and that he, you know, he's well received as the king's messenger. You know, that you attune yourself to, the more one, you know, it says a tzaddik is judged by a hair's breadth. That he is, it's like climbing up a triangle, a pyramid. When you get to the top, there's a very narrow peak, and one has to be very careful how to stand there. When you're down at the bottom, it's easier, somewhat easier. When you get closer to this, so that someone who's, but because he's so, by the time you get up there, you're already like attuned to conducting yourself in a certain way, and you know, it's not easy, but it can be done. That everyone is, this idea that man can perfect himself without, not without the help of God, but that essentially he begins the task, and it says you know, if you a small measure here, and will be given a great measure above. Like, oh, if you open for me a crack, I will fill you with, you know, wondrous thing. I know. If you open just a tiny crack, I will send through like armies. Like, you know.
Back to your conversion, a couple of things, because I want to also continue with this concept of piety, but. In a procedural sense, there is a ceremony. You mentioned circumcision.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, I had already been circumcised when I was at birth, a short day after. So that's they draw a drop of blood for the sins, because it hadn't been done, of course, for Jewish, you know, for religious purposes. So they draw a drop of blood for the sake of the covenant. And then after that, you're immersed in a mikveh. And they ask you before, do you understand what you're undertaking? Do you agree to accept these obligations? This is not something to be taken lightly. And once you make, you know, affirmative answers, then they go ahead and they say, all right, they draw a drop of blood. And they say, enough. I said, yes. And then they say, go immerse yourself, make bracha. And then you do this before three rabbis, and then after that they give you a thing saying so and so came before. They give you like a certificate saying so and so came before us. We examined him, and we he was properly immersed under our supervision, and he chose the name Abraham, and they signed it.
And you chose.
Converts frequently take the name Abraham because Abraham was the first considered like the father of all believing Jews.
And you were already living in Crown Heights.
Yeah, I moved into Crown Heights in at Passover time. Rabbi Jacobson helped me find an apartment. He gave me someone to get in touch with. I found an apartment on New York Avenue next to synagogue. Right across from the police station.
So it was 1970.
1970, yeah.
What was the neighborhood like from a demographic, ethnic?
It was more spread out in some ways. I remember there were quite a few Jewish stores along Noskin Avenue, and there was even some on Rogers Avenue. There was a synagogue on Rogers. Apparently there were... there was a shul on Franklin Avenue. There were many more at Bedford Avenue, a German shul. I was working full time, so I really didn't get a chance to do that much exploration except on the weekends. Sometimes I would walk around and stuff like that. But I was working here at the university, so I really didn't come home. And
you were studying.
Studying, and I was taking courses and stuff like that. So by the time I got home late in the evening, ate something, went to bed, got up in the morning. I didn't really get a chance to go too much. But as I say, it was more spread out. The Jews were concentrated more spread out than they are now. But there were less of them. The community has grown tremendously.
Fewer
Lubavitchers. There were still some other ones here. Most of them are moving away. They were in the process of moving out. But there were other groups here besides the Slotmar was here. And a few large groups. I think Babo had just recently moved out.
Slotmar and Babo were in Crown Heights?
Babo used to be over on the other side of Eastern Parkway, I think the Lincoln Place or somewhere. But they had moved out a couple of years before I came in. And the Boston Rebbe used to live next door to the Rebbe's house on President Street, President near New York Avenue. That was empty when I came here. Boston Shul was empty. Later became co-ops or something like that.
Does that imply that each Hasidic group had its Rebbe?
The Satmar one was never here. They were always in Williamsburg. There was a Satmar shul on Kingston Avenue. It's now in the middle of between Montgomery. It's now Rabbi Shane. They call it Shane Shul. Shane is a Moyle, and I don't know if he owns the building, but he uses it anyway. Shul is still there, but it's not Satmar. It hasn't been Satmar for 15 years ago. After the lobby, Satmar had been a little mixed up thing.
That was based on different points of view about Israel?
A lot of little things that had sort of bunched up over time.
Yes, I remember reading something about the different responses to the raid on Entebbe. How
Lubavitcher thought. Lubavitcher thought it was miraculous. Satmar has always been very anti the state of Israel. And Lubavitcher has been something. They were originally also, but they've sort of accepted the fact that it's the only way to get things accomplished. Temporal sense, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. So what about the presence of African Americans and Caribbeans in the early 70s?
Most of Kingston Avenue, most of the shops were black, with very few exceptions. Most of Kingston Avenue stores were black. largely black-owned at that time. I mean, there were a few Jewish stores, but much less than that. Now there's hardly any black stores, maybe one. There's a cleaner, one or two now, but before there were mostly black shops on Kingston Avenue.
Is it one of the kind of dry goods stores not owned by Jews? With canned foods and household?
There's a Spanish one near Montgomery Street.
Right.
He's been there a long time. There used to be a restaurant next to him that was there for many, many years. A Haitian restaurant, I think it was. Shea Price or Shea Prince. He was there for a long time. But there used to be several candy stores, a lot of shops there that were not, most of the shops there were not Jewish. Mercan's now was, Lipsker had a store, Lipsker Brothers had a grocery store there. There were always a few shops there, but there were much less than there are now.
So as the Lubavitcher population has increased, do you sense it's more through Balei Tshuva? Is it?
No, I mean the Lubavitchers have large families, and many of them have settled here. They don't move away. I mean, some of them may go out when they first get married. They may go out for a year or two on Shlivos, but when they come back here, most of them eventually do settle in Crown Heights. Like as they, you know, that they have large families and they need and they've been acquiring. See, there was, as the non-Lubavitch Jewish community was moving out, most of the Lubavitchers at that time did not have the money to acquire. A few who were fairly well to do acquired homes like right away. But most of the Lubavitchers were living in apartments or whatever like that, and the blacks bought homes.
We're continuing on tape two with Abraham Crawford. Abraham, you were talking, about the changes. There were mostly professional African-Americans, and I suppose some Canadians.
Yeah, West Indians
were coming in. Are they still there?
Yeah, they seem to be. Most of them seem to be. They don't... They don't seem to have as large families. I think they turn over housing somewhat faster than. They say the average turnover time is about 30 years here in New York City for.
Hello.
Private.
The average time is what?
About 30 years or something like that for turnover of private housing stock. Is about a 30-year cycle, like the time someone acquires and the time next comes up on the market is approximately 30 years.
Well, what are prices like now?
We got a really good buy. We got one for 140, but it needs a tremendous amount of work. This house has never changed hands before. This is very unusual. This was in the same family from when it was originally.
A Jewish family?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, this man was a kosher butcher. And he bought the house, like, I think in 1982. I think that's when those houses were built. And his daughter, when she married, lived in that house and raised her family there.
So they were Orthodox who became Lubavitcher?
No, they weren't Lubavitch. It wasn't a Lubavitch family, but they were Orthodox. In fact, they built an extra room on the house, which they had, so you could open up the ceiling for a sukkah.
Oh, how great.
So that's roofed, it's closed up now, but when it was first built, I mean, I think they built it like, because the kitchen is extremely small, just a sink. And we have a stove and a refrigerator in there. That's probably all. And then the back wall of the house would have been there. But now they put on this extra room. And along one wall are all cabinets, presumably they use for the overflow of the kitchen because it's like no, just no workspace. There's no counters.
So how can you have no hook inflation?
Well, I mean, we worked out a temporary scheme where we planned to put in the kitchen back where this extra room is, hopefully for pad. But apparently at that time, they had very few, utensils or whatever like that. I mean,
it's a single family house?
Yeah. You can tell at one time, apparently it was one of these very grand, well, most of the paneling and stuff has been painted over, but the floors and stuff like that, and has one of these big, metal gates, metal doors. And apparently one time it was a very grand home, that's been let, run down shamefully.
So from whom did you
own? We bought it from the estate of the...
the daughter?
Yeah.
Well, she died
in 85, I think, and they haven't grandson lived there for a while. And,
but in general, what are prices like in the when these new families
They go for like somewhere between 2 and 3. Like somewhere around 250 might be like a good because as I say, people want to be close to the river, and those who can afford to pay for the privilege pay for it.
But what do poorer families do?
Well, I mean, some people, if they have a two-family, a lot of the houses are two-family, or they've been converted to two-family. They smaller families, when people start out, will rent the floor. But a large family, see, the thing is, really large families frequently take a two-family house turn into a one-family house.
You can't help but wonder where a mother, father with 10 children, and maybe a senior citizen generation live.
Yeah, well, and you need either a very large apartment or a house, one or the other. And the very large apartments are becoming scarcer and harder to find because people who have large families frequently, they take the whole house for themselves or they take the other floor for one of the children or the married child or something like that. Mm-hmm. And there's, most of the apartment houses, even those that have like 3 bedrooms, the bedrooms are usually very tiny bedrooms, hardly, unless you stack the kids up like. But you see, go into some houses, and like they will have like the beds off the living room.
And bunk beds.
Yeah, bunk beds. Yeah, right.
There's something I've been wondering about, which Aviva Siegel and I have talked about a little bit, and perhaps you could talk about the acceptance of a Baal Tshuva in addition to the conversion aspect of your.
Most Baal Tshuvas, of course, are not born Jewish, but they don't require conversion. But frequently it's not so much coming back because most of them never really had any extensive, they had minimal exposure to when people who come from like Reform or conservative families were, they were born Jewish and they probably had like a bris or whatever when they were born, but they certainly didn't have any extensive. Had like at best a very mediocre preparation in sort of Jewish education. So,
but wait, Avram, when you say come back, could you
tshuva means return.
Return.
And it's like coming back to your roots or whatever like that. But I mean, the roots are there in a physical and spiritual sense, but intellectually the roots are usually not existent or very tenuous. I mean, people you see in people's houses, like that picture of the grandfather, and the grandfathers were with big yarmulkes and maybe a beard or something. Like that. They came from, there's a whole like lost generation, just under economic pressures or whatever, social pressures of assimilation, whatever like that, they found themselves. There were exceptions, there were some families who never, but this was unusual. Like there was a whole, they went to school, they acquired an education, they went into business, and Judaism got sort of pushed to the side, like while they were trying to, fit in. And after the children came back, and the next generation came back. Mm-hmm.
So, as something hits, and without belaboring the point, something catches a young man, old man, a woman, and they begin to study. Eventually, moving to Crown Heights. What is the vibe with the FFBs, as they're called, the lifers?
They were raised, went to school, and they you know, they're committed to this. I mean, they don't know any other, they don't know any alternative, or they're not willing, you know, they're not working with that model. You know, it's not just not the way they see things. I mean, they don't, you know, follow the movies, I mean, because this is just not the, but someone who comes, Baal Teshuva, who's already familiar with, you know, he has decided that he's going to, henceforth adopt a certain, you know, different way of thinking. He sees the shallowness or whatever of the this world, and he's, you know, going to take a more spiritual, he's realized that a lot of this is very superficial, very transitory.
So in, for example, the story about Dr. Karp and his marriage into a family.
Yeah. I mean, he was...
that was 20.
Late 60s, I guess he came here. He was...
That was one of the first...
Probably somewhere in the middle 60s, there was a fairly small... This Rabbi Jacobson was one of the founders of Hadar Torah, which is where...
Hadar Torah, which was founded
maybe a couple of years before. I arrived here, as I say, I first went to see him in 67, I think. And it had, I guess it was around a couple of years before that, maybe in 65 or something like that, it started. And Rabbi Jacobson, there was a need for some... like a yeshiva where people, where male Baal Teshuvas could go to get, I mean, like, you know, they would be embarrassed, like learning Aleph based, and, you know, like a, but this, they came here with little more than that, and they needed to get some kind of a fundamental Jewish background at an adult level of instruction, and he put together this, a yeshiva where someone could, an adult could come in and learn either full-time or part-time and take some courses and, you know, just what this was all about. They came in here, the Lubavitch sent like chaplains, whatever, to college campuses, and frequently a lot of people like showed up here. And there was, you know, they're simply, you know, they're welcome to come for Shabbos and something like that, but there was little more available. So he put together this institution
Where would the young men live if they wanted to study?
If they wanted, they eventually got dormitories, and I mean, they acquired a couple of buildings, and they put together a couple of classrooms and a base medrash, and then they put together some dormitories over this where the people could stay. I mean, they could make arrangements with families and stuff like that, but most of the people could take someone for Shabbos, but they couldn't take them for any extended, maybe a 2-day weekend, you know, Yom Kippur or something like that. But for anything more, like much more than this, they would, you know,
so
have to make other arrangements.
On this kind of day-to-day social awareness, the courtships, the meeting of young women, when the young men, such as you, showed that this was serious, it wasn't just a glib touch with
you. Yeah, then they set up. Shortly after that, then, you know, where the young men were, then there was a similar phenomenon occurring with young ladies. But young ladies have to be more carefully. They're not. They needed not chaperones, but they needed to be, you know, more carefully. They wanted somewhat more. So they set up this machon kana. And
what's machon mean?
Machon means like tent.
Oh, like machon.
Yeah, Machne, the tribe of Kana's crowd, or whatever.
Yes, so, well, there are dormitories in the Mahan.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they as I say, once the idea was there, and they saw it was the need was recognized, and they went about setting up.
But since education is so separate,
this is the main. Education is, I mean, you can't, obviously, someone who's ignorant cannot do, you know, if you don't know what, you know, you're required to pray, or you have to learn. Like, education is not something that ends like a bar mitzvah or something like that. This is just the beginning of it's a lifelong, but it's separate. I mean, different, men and women have followed different educational paths, and you have to set up separate institutions.
Well, are they separate because of gender, or are they separate because of curriculum?
Both. I mean, I think the curriculum is largely tailored to, I suppose it's whatever, you know, perceived lifestyle, I mean, that you expect them to eventually end up with. I mean, women, it's, in Europe, they barely used to teach women olive base. I mean, women learned how to read a sitter, and there were very few women who went much beyond that. There were a few who were, you know, studied, but women never studied Gemara or codes or any of this. First, you have to know, like, I mean, first, before you can learn the law codes, you have to learn, like, the sources, which is Gemara.
But how does that land on your university, the aspect of your university self where everybody was studying everything, regardless?
Well, I mean, I think, I mean, I don't see it. There's no reason why women can't. It's just they don't usually get enough in-depth background at the foundation. I mean, they usually... before you can properly go into Gemara, like, I mean, you have to learn Aramaic. And since, I mean, it's Mishnah, you have to memorize Mishnah, Gemara is like a commentary on the Mishnah. So before you can really do Gemara, you have to memorize the Mishnahs. And all the women usually, like, stop just before the Mishnah, I mean, just before, like, you get into the heavy stuff. I mean, they usually stop somewhere like, there's no good reason, but you know, that's just the traditional curriculum, I think.
What about your daughter? We're skipping.
Well, I mean, the Beis Rivka now. They don't go into the. They don't usually learn Gemara. They may, you know, learn how to a few pieces here and there, but they don't learn in what they go in inside. They don't learn in depth. Like before you can learn, you have to learn how to learn, and to really learn this stuff with. There's two ways you can learn how to learn, like do a page a day, which you do it very superficially, or you can spend weeks on a page and go very deep into it. I mean, like learn, you know, how it's cut together and everything. And this is why, like in a semester class in Gemara, they will learn like maybe three or four pages, but they will learn them in great depth.
Is there an expression in Yiddish or Hebrew for that depth? Like, this is a style of learning?
Well, I mean, this is, there are different derricks of how to do this, but I mean, you need someone, usually they start out, they learn like there's certain what they call lamdish in the sectors, usually ones that have to do with cases in civil law, and they get fairly complex damages. But once you learn how to learn through these very difficult ones, all the other ones come much easier. They usually start in on what they call the Baba Mitzia, Baba. These are like the central civil law codes.
Baba
Kama, Baba Metzia, Baba Basra. The three Babas. And these are like, they're big, heavy, I mean, physically heavy and mentally heavy. In the center of the Gemara. They deal with civil damages. Like if someone has a nox and he damages someone else's field. Who's responsible? Was he warned about this before? And it gets very, very. But if you can work your way through that, then all the other ones about Shabbos and stuff seem much, much easier going. Like, and of course, there's a whole section of Gemara called Women, and this has to do with things like marriage and divorces and dowries and things like that. Who brings what, and who takes what, and who's responsible for this, and if this happened, and that happened. These are other ones they learn also. There's a cycle, like, they learn certain ones each year. Then the ones that have to do with the holidays, Rosh Hashanah. Sometimes a Sukkot, and Shabbos is a big Gemara, and Yom Kippur, Yom, and several, there's like a 60-volume set, and some of them are very small, with not too much commentary, and other ones are, you know, take up like 300 or 400 pages, like, and they're really difficult. But not everyone knows most people don't. If they say there are, if you go through like a page a day, it's like 7 years to finish the Gemara.
Right, I know a man who's doing that.
Yeah. Daf Yomi, if you do a side a day, right. Like it takes you 7 years, yeah.
Right, right. Back to just the more social aspects of STEM. When Balchuvas come, schooling is separate. You're not really mixing.
Mm.
How do people meet one another?
Well, the senior people who run these things, teachers and administrators and stuff like that, besides like supervising the the academic
side,
will also keep an eye on like who they think. I mean, they get to know. They usually have these people by their house for Shabbos and they alumni and stuff like that. People will might quietly investigate, and they will, as people get more and more advanced in their studies, have been here longer and longer, they will be sounded out as to whether they're interested. I mean, most people, it turns out, are interested, and they will. People try and make suitable. People try and make suitable matches. There's, there are difficult cases. There are people who are, obviously have problems, and are not easily matchable. They're already been. They have to be sounded out, like as to what they're looking for, and where they're from.
Parenthetically, Avram, is one thing I've noticed is that there's not a lot of asking about where you came from, and a lot of questions about your pre-Lubavitcher
life,
or so I perceive.
It doesn't come up. It might come up in certain contexts, but it doesn't. It's not routinely raised.
Is there a code of behavior that?
No, I mean, if you come and conduct yourself properly, you don't give people occasion to ask, then ordinarily they won't. I mean.
Right. Do you feel, or did you feel that you were being watched more?
Well, I mean, I came under sort of unusual circumstances, but I also came under Rabbi Jacobson's auspices, and this was a very good. But the main thing they watch is, if someone conducts themselves properly, then, then they accept you. If you daven three times a day and put on the film and keep kosher, and this is the test. I mean, this is to say, like, Judaism is orthopraxy, not believe so much, but doing. If someone conducts himself in a proper manner, then he's accepted. People don't question you too much about your philosophical background, philosophical, how you work these things out. If you put on tefillin, they don't ask you your kibbutz, usually come up. It's the doing. It's just this state of
kavana, meaning
kavana means like the intention, what you have.
Intention.
Some things require, like someone, because when you make matzah, if you pour the water on the flour, and that's what you intend to do, then you have somebody admit that's the right thing. But if the water falls on the flower accidentally, then that's it requires kavanah. You must pour the water on with the intention of making.
Great example. So how did you meet?
Well, I was a friend of mine. He was staying with me. He roomed with me for like several years. He brought up someone to look at his books one day. He was quite a collector of books, and one Shabbos afternoon he brought someone to take a look at the books. So I had known him. I knew the man to see him on the street, but the first time he ever been in the apartment, so he came up and looked.
You were sharing an apartment?
Someone moved in with me like shortly. I was by myself when I first moved there, but someone came in with me and shared the apartment like for the last. He was there with me like about 4 years or something. So he brought this fellow up and look at his books one Shabbos afternoon. So the next, I think the following week, the fellow had me over for Shabbos night. And the next week, his wife called me up and asked me if I would like to meet someone. And we went out, and shortly after that, we became engaged.
I was told that couples weren't really allowed to be alone.
They're not supposed to be alone in a place where no one else can. They're not supposed to be alone, like in a in a bedroom or something, somewhere
Oh, but they can be in public as a couple.
Yeah, but people are usually discreet, like, until they don't want to get out that they're, you know, people usually don't, like, walk through the neighborhood with someone. I mean, they meet someone at someone's house, and they go out quietly until things are somewhat along. They don't usually appear together in public. That's, I mean, they don't want people to get talking together.
I'm sure.
Even with the best of intention.
Right.
Sometimes things are misunderstood, but...
And Sari was brought up Jewish?
Yeah, sure.
But not Lubavitch?
Not Lubavitch, no. But she did go to Lubavitch. She went to Lubavitch schools until she was... like Lubavitch Grammar School, I guess, up in Massachusetts, in Springfield, Rabbi Edelman had Lubavitch School there, and they went there to, like, about, I guess, the grammar school, I guess they call it, eighth grade or something like that. They didn't have a high school up there, but they didn't have any girls' high school, but they did have, like, I think they had mixed classes till about 12 years old or something. So she had some of background, like, she had Lubavitch background.
Right.
And when she went to high school, I mean, she went away from that.
High school was yeshiva? Or
no, she went to a public, in Holyoke, Massachusetts. She went to.
So she moved to Crown Heights as a
girl? When she came back to Crown Heights. She came
back from Israel?
Yeah, when she came back from Israel, she came to Crown Heights. She was going to learn Machon Kana, and she had taken a few classes there, but she never really... she came back around just around the holiday time, I think. Anyway, she was here in Crown Heights, and shortly after that, I met her. I think she came back. She was here in Crown Heights a while. I think she was working. Yeah, she was working. She was working for Nayana.
Oh, good. How long after your conversion did you meet?
About 5 years. I came here in 70. I met her in. We got married in November of 75. I met her, I think, early in July. Or somewhere in
Then children born into the community, is there a greater sense of belonging?
Oh, yes. I mean, my kids consider themselves Lubavitch.
Right.
And they've gone to Lubavitch schools all their life. And, you know, most of their friends are Lubavitch. And, you know, I mean, we have cousins and stuff who aren't Lubavitch, so they know that there are other ways, you know, the Jewish ways, but their own immediate circle is Lubavitch.
Do they know their Catholic cousins?
Yes, they know them. I mean, my sister is here in New York. I have one sister here in New York, but everyone else, my brothers are down in Georgia now, and my other sister is in Florida, but I have one sister out in Ozone Park that I see occasionally. We've never been in their house, but they've been, they used to come to my parents' house. My parents' house was sold last December, they sold that, so we would see them there occasionally. We saw them at my father's funeral. We saw them. The oldest one, I think, was there, not the two younger ones. They know them, but they're not close. You know.
Well, it's probably a more diverse exposure for them than most of them.
Oh, yes, yeah, right. No, it's unusual. There are a few other converts that I know of. Mm-hmm. In Lubavitch. But as if people don't usually advertise it, once they're married, it usually doesn't come up. But as I say, I was feeling, well, no, every so often they would call me up and ask me to speak to someone or right. Someone who was considering converting or something. So I wasn't a rabbi, so I couldn't, you know, do anything official about the conversion, but I would sound them out and I would recommend they speak to Rabbi so-and-so who I felt would be helpful or whatever.
Since you work in a university and you're product of university intellectual approach to things, as I'm sure as well as spiritual, how does that affect your attitude toward your own children's access to higher education?
Well, I mean, my children can go here. They're a bit. None of them are old enough to go yet. My daughter has almost finished high school, so she would be the first one to move. But they can go here for free. My children can get free tuition.
Wow.
Up through a master's degree.
Avram.
So this is a big...
That's fantastic.
They can go free. I can get all the degrees. I can get
And Surrey too.
And Surrey too, yeah. But we're limited to like 9 credits a semester. But they can take a full load. All the tuition is covered. Nothing else. No fees or anything. But just tuition is free. They get free tuition. For up to a master's degree.
Fantastic. But you know, I can't help it. But
I mean, so when if they're up to it and that's what they want, of course I'll encourage them to take advantage of it.
Well, Nahami is knockout on the telephone.
I think as soon as they go through seminary, but they have like an extra 2 years after high school, and they get like a teaching certificate or something like that. If she wants to take that there, Beis Rivka, or if she wants to go to Israel for a while and learn there. But if she wants to take your undergraduate degree here, of course they have to be admitted and stuff. They have to still go through it. But that's it's like once they get in, certainly encourage it.
When you talk to other parents and you hear the kind of ceiling on higher education, what does that do?
Well, I mean, not everyone is cut out to be a full-time rabbi. Most of the people don't practice. It becomes a question of, these people have to, if they plan to have families and support them, you can only go so far without some kind of education. I mean, some of them are very bright people, and it's, if you're going to be a rabbi and earn a living doing this, good. If you're, if you're satisfied with it. It's just that the income and stuff, like unless you're really unusually capable and determined, it seems that like most of these people are limiting themselves as far as
with the women too, though.
There are some of them do, some of them are very active and all kinds of things, and they do teach that they run the Beis Rivka system in Machon Tana, and there's lots of activities going on, and a college degree is not essential, but unless you're prepared to really work in this mold, it just seems to me like it's I think if one approaches it carefully, there are some people they have this. People take courses on computers and stuff like that. There are some people
within the yeshiva system.
Well, they have one when IBM many years ago. IBM sent a program here for computer programmers, and they got some good ones out of it. They got some people who were they sent people here, and they had it at the yeshiva, or the yeshiva sponsored it anyway. Shortly before I arrived, and IBM was quite satisfied. But then never repeated it. I guess probably at that time computers were starting to come in, maybe from the universities and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And but they had a program here, and some people did very well. But apparently, the same kind of sort of mental tools, were transferable, like to one field to another.
Right, it's hard to see how, with a one-income family from the father, and a person who's involved in education, whether it's a principal or a teacher.
Some of these schools get paid very. The salaries are not high.
Tuition's not high either.
Well, the tuition, they give a lot of scholarships. See, they have. They're different. These yeshivas, first, someone gets some federal funding, which is just not for bus transport, whatever like that. But they have a few wealthy donors who sort of carry, and they get to, of course, the buildings are tax exempt, so somehow they put together a package. But the ones that get left out frequently are the teachers. I mean, the lunches are paid for, the buses are paid for, and the building is tax free. And then from the few wealthy contributors and the few people who pay, try to put together enough for salaries and stuff.
But with 12 children.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult. And some of these people
rice and beans.
Yeah, some of these people put a great deal of effort into it's really not an easy. But somehow people manage it. I don't know. It's very
album, it's just on sheer arithmetic. It's sometimes very hard to figure out with all the admiration in the world. But this, you know, back to this allusion to wealthy donors. You know, one of the images is that the Jews are buying up property and so forth, and that the movement is so wealthy.
The movement is not wealthy. There are a few very wealthy people, a few people in diamond, a few people who are really either millionaires or very close to millionaires. But there are these few people cannot carry the whole community. I mean, no matter how generously they give. I mean, they have a few wealthy people like on boards of directors with all these yeshivas and things like that, and they do contribute very gently. The guy who makes these Sergio Jean, he was on like board.
Is he Lubavitch or he got to Lubavitch?
They have people who are like friendly towards them. Over the years, like they put together like JJ Hector, all the show, was very outgoing, and he knew a lot of politicians some people who had came from Orthodox families, and were still sort of like Orthodox themselves, but they're really not that. But he put together like a network of wealthy contributors, and you know, some of them farmed themselves out into other institutions, and they try and support these things. But even like a couple of $100,000 a year is only like, you know, will only go so far, can only be stretched so far. Like, but they try and. You know, this proves there's a God in these institutions, and they hope to succeed. Like, you know.
Right. If we could just talk about Crown Heights a minute, the question that Craig, my partner, and I are always asking the people is, if you could tell your non-Jewish neighbors something about being Lubavitch. Mm. What would it be? Just as Craig is asking, if you could tell someone about being Haitian, what would you want people to know?
Well, I mean, Lubavitch, the original, I mean, the word, the Yobam in Russian means like city of love. And Lubavitch was always a very outgoing movement that the one who founded Lubavitch, the Alter Rebbe, was like one of the early disciples of the Mezuzah Maggid. He said that this going out like it, this is the whole. I mean that this you have to spread out like this. The Chassidus, it says there's two aspects to Chassidus. One is lifnei mesheres hadin, to go beyond the letter of the law, that the Chassidimer not just set aside to do things like minimally, but they want to do things maximally. And the other thing is, everything must be with joy. It says the Abish, the God does not want sort of grudging, like cranky service. He doesn't want people to say they're celebrating Pesach in quotes and really, you know, fetch and complain that, you know, it says the Arizal said that the whole wandering in the wilderness, the 40 years exile in the wilderness, was only because you did not serve me with joy. He wants alles besimka, everything has to be with joy. This is to be very strict and careful about how you do things, but it must be done with joy. That this is, you know, we are privileged to serve God. This is a calling, a privilege, a high mission, and you know, you can't complain, you know.
Well, while charity and service begins at home, how can this operative mode of joy, service, and giving be translated into goodwill with racially and religiously
divided
people?
Yeah, I think we have to recognize that, you know, the Avishter has many, many shluchim, many messengers, many servants. The whole world, I mean, this is Einoid, there is nothing else. It says, if you realize what this means, this whole world is godliness. There is nothing in this whole world. There's not God in anything else. This is always the one in philosophy, one of the problems has always been like what they call the problem of evil. if God is all good, then how can evil exist? Either he's not all good, or he's not all powerful, or he's not all knowing. I mean, that we say that the world is intrinsically good. Evil is only from our point of view. It is things that are incomplete, unfulfilled, unfinished, whatever. And our job is to finish them. See, it's like one of the differences between Christianity and Judaism is there are no public toilets in St. Patrick's Cathedral. Because they don't see a need for this. They don't see people as humans, as they've already spiritualized them to men are not angels, but the men are men. And the task of man is to lift up, to transform, to sanctify everything. This is to reveal the godliness that's in this world. And when we see our neighbors, no matter what the color is, I mean, this is part of, you know, it says that I've sent you into exile only to make many converts. And, you know, it says Abraham went out from Haran with the souls. And says, what does this mean, the souls he had gotten there? It says, like, people he had converted in his household, in a broad sense, means those servants he had acquired and converted, both by, you know, personal example and by, you know, the fact he had purchased them, but as members of his household. But that was the ordinary way of acquiring in those days. But he had also converted them literally because he had impressed them with his, you know, avoted his devotion, his mission, like
his work.
Yeah, this was his work.
Right, but that's for every person.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the observations that many of our African American and Caribbean neighbors have said is that the Jews don't want to talk to us, and yet when you talk,
it's not that we don't want to talk to them. Unfortunately, there's little common ground to talk about, unless you're going to talk about, you know, trivialities.
That's a start.
Yeah, I mean, but people, you know, the weather and stuff like that. We're out, you know, unless, you know, it's a snowstorm, you know. Ordinarily, they're not in-depth topics. I mean, neighbors will talk about, you know, immediate concerns, like getting the street shoveled or something. But as the root, the common, the shared ground is usually very small. And I mean, it's not that we don't want to talk to them, but the topics of conversation are few. Topics of common conversation are few. Since the kids don't attend the same schools, or you know, I mean, like people next door to us. Is a very, very interesting. She was very close to this. She's been there like 38 years, and she was very close to Mrs. Fay, and she had the key to the house. And, like, someone, there was no one living there in case something went wrong or something like that, so she could keep an eye on things.
This is a black woman.
Yeah, and she's been there like 38 years and raised a family there. And we spoke to her, and she was very close to Mrs. Fay.
Mrs. Fay is the daughter.
Daughter of the original owner. Yeah.
Right.
And she's a very, very nice woman. But after we talk about the immediate block or something, you know, there's not too much. I mean, if she asks you something, you can say, oh, well, you know, we do it because of this or that. She says, I always notice the light in the can. You can explain things, but it doesn't really ordinarily get beyond the sort of a very, you know, trivial stage. I mean, it doesn't usually go into. Especially as a conversational, you know, it'll broaden as people have to start somewhere, and then I suppose, you know, it'll, like a drop of water, you know, a stone in water, the circle will spread out, you know, and if you start conversation on small matters, then, you know, eventually they'll probably come to more substantial topics.
If you were to wonder about aspects of her life,
mm-hmm.
Where she went to church, where she
she's totally her and her sister sit on the we as I said, we can I think it's finding, you know, like I was saying before about the you know, we're finding what values how other people construct their models. We know how we construct our model of the world, and You need a set of translation functions. You have to see what values they assign to the variables, what things they hold to be important. Then you have to make a set of functions that a function relates to, you know, not a known quantity and a not known quantity. But you have to do a set of a translation. Every understanding is essentially a translation. What you do is you make a mapping from one model to another model.
And what are the Roman numerals that you would put on the functions? What are the variables that one would want to
put? When you say something, you say X means, means is like a function sign. What you have to do is set up an equation.
Right.
And say what stands on what, you know, what the variable, what range of values the variable.
Let me toss out an example. Piety is a precept.
Yeah. Piety.
Would you put that as a?
It depends. In quotes, like, I mean, piety means such and such. Means conduct. Chesed. I mean, there's different translations of it. Maybe piety. I mean, rectitude, righteousness. You have to see how it translates. Look at the dictionary. Probably piety has many meanings. Once you figure out what the dictionary meanings are, then you have to find out what the real world meanings are. What it means to exemplify piety, like, you know.
Well, exactly. If you take an anthropological approach, mm-hmm. it's the cultural relativistic
framework. Right. Yeah. This is the.
So that's the what were you saying? The template.
Yeah. This is the original Socrates. Socrates of the. The problem there, you know, he said, "I'm prosecuting." When he met someone by the law courts, "What are you doing here?" He said, "I'm prosecuting my father for impiety." He's what? Yes, he was supposed to make a certain, just take care of a certain, clear of a certain thing after someone died or something like that. And he didn't do it. Now I'm. This is proper to prosecute your father. You know, what is piety? I mean, was piety like merely observing religious taboos, or is it, you know, proper conduct? Yeah, right. Piety is a, you know, tzaddik. It says a tzaddik. What is a tzaddik? A tzaddik is a, you know, righteous person. But righteousness has many ramifications, many meanings. Like, it says someone who it's a way of conducting oneself, but it's also a certain way of, you know, carrying out one's whole life. Like,
well, I suppose the question is, do the same words exist in the lexicon of people of other cultures, mm-hmm. and what do they mean?
Right,
I mean,
the meanings can be very, very different. I mean,
what would you show? I mean, obviously, you've traveled, you've been in museums. What would you show of Lubavitch life?
I mean, there have been several books on Lubavitch, and some of them are pretty good.
Oh, which ones do you think are good? I'm really interested.
There's one called People. It's covered by Mintz, stories and stuff. They have a few pictures in there, not too many. But I think the family, the family life is very important. I think that's like one of the corners. I mean, I think, well, I mean, there's a lot of Orthodox Jewish life in general, but the family and the schools and, you know, the religious observance, you know, the holidays and the Shabbos and stuff follow, you know, naturally from this. In Europe, like, Hasidus was not considered, like, very different from the ordinary. I mean, here in the United States, it stands out because, but in Europe, like, I mean, the ordinary, like, yeshiva type, I mean, here, because people have fallen so far away, it stands out. But over there, I mean, Hasidim were just another Jewish, not very different from their non, you know, Hasidic neighbors. Mm-hmm. I mean, they all had a similar standard of observance. I mean, it's like someone who didn't observe the Sabbath was considered, like, very unusual, you know, until they got here. And, you know, everyone kept, because there was only, like, one, you know, maybe one butcher for the whole, you know. It wasn't, it's only here, like, it's become more tenured, you know, more.
The differences in points of, in interpretations of the word Messiah, meaning anointed one.
We said the Messiah has not yet come. Right. We're still waiting for him. We stressed that the Messiah is essentially a human being who is an agent of God, but he's not God. Mm-hmm. And he is sent here on a specific mission, just like we all are. But I mean, his mission is to be like the culmination of the finish off the work of God in this world. I mean, just to bring things to fulfillment. And
fulfillment meaning?
Meaning that. Like someone who puts the finishing touches on the thing. I mean, it says that the, like preparing for the Sabbath. It says like the Sabbath, the world will, is now like towards the end of the, almost the end of the final, we're in 57:54 coming up. We're late in the afternoon of Erev Sabbath. We're late in the afternoon of the Sabbath. And the Sabbath will be like the, just like all the days of the work, all the days of the week are preparations for the Sabbath. So the days of the world are preparations for like for the coming Mashiach. Mashiach will be the, like the king, you know, it says, the Rambam says something like he will. He will come and he will show things. Says he will be a man. He will be a flesh and blood, but he will be the king's chosen representative. He will be the king's,
Well, I guess what I was asking then is the agents of bringing Messiah that we are. Mm. Does that mean that that in this godliness? In each person,
mm-hmm. Everyone has a specific task to do, and so sometimes you find yourself like walking down a. But it says realize that everything you touch is. It says there are sparks that have been waiting for you alone from the dawn of creation. That you only you have the power to work with this. Like Abraham said when they offered to give him a share of the booty, he said the. Know that I haven't touched so much as a shoelace, because he couldn't. There were certain, they were not his to work with. People can only work with. It says that you shouldn't covet your neighbor's property because you can't. You have no business there. That those are not your neighbor has to take care of using that. When your clothes wear out or you find something, it means it's you've either lost the chance or you've accomplished it. One or the other. That either you accomplish a mission with regard to this object or it's passed on to someone else. That whatever you had to take care of, you have to be very careful whether you keeping your accounts, whether you've taken care of your business or.
So just in one wrap up, if you could communicate one thing to your non-Jewish neighbors, what would you want them to know about you?
Well, I came here and I've been well received and I enjoy being a part of the community and I think you have to, like anything else, you have to work at being a Lubavitch is like a privilege. I mean, you're as close to the group or as much a part of it as you want to be, and it's a certain way of conducting oneself, and insofar as you take these things on yourself, you. you assume the group's values, or you see things in there. But I mean, and this is the same, I mean, that the way we present ourselves to the outside world shouldn't leave them thinking Lubavitch is cold or unfriendly. As I say, Lubavitch, the word is love, and this love is, I mean, in it's not it's extended first to other Jews, but I mean it also extends to our non-Jewish neighbors. And I think here, you know, before in Europe, I mean, the Christianity was much more intense, and probably Judaism also, and there was a mutual, they sort of distanced themselves from each other. I mean, in a certain sense, the Jewish community contracted from their neighbor, recoiled from the neighbors, because the neighbors were not particularly anxious to. I think people misunderstand Judaism because they never really made great efforts to find out exactly what Jews believe, or what the inside of the synagogue looks like, or what a Torah. I mean, if they realized that the how much Christianity both borrows from and diverges from Judaism. I mean, this might be a start. That, I mean, Christianity is a more outgoing religion by nature, and Judaism teaches more by example than by. See, Christianity has spread itself largely by like propaganda and sword. Depending on what the circumstances were, once it was adopted as the official religion of the Roman Empire, then it became like sort of almost mandatory to be a Christian, and Jews were merely tolerated, usually somewhat reluctantly. And in Muslim countries also, Judaism and Christianity both became like tolerated religions. I mean, they couldn't deny their roots in Judaism, but they certainly didn't encourage it. They barely let the Jewish communities, you know, stay on. And the same way under Christianity. I mean, officially they were tolerated, but the common people who, you know, weren't into theological subtleties saw like this toleration as an excuse for since this church barely tolerated them, you know, people, you know, went one better and did, tolerated them still less. I mean, I think the roots of anti-Semitism lay in like an envy and a, you know, a grudging admission that their Judaism offers a way of picking up the same things without the intellectual difficulties that Christianity offers. I think most of the people may have chafed at the responsibilities of Christianity and saw that Jews were like, you know, free of this, and you know, could still seem to have, you know, much the same
Well, I'm not sure the tack that the exhibitions will take. But one thing is becoming quite clear to us, and that is that the sheer fact of doing this exhibition is offering people a setting in which those questions are certainly.
Yeah, they've had shows from time to time at the Brooklyn Museum, not the
right.
From time to time, we once went down there to see some movie. I think it was a movie. Film shorts, and there was an exhibition of paintings and Hasidic paintings. And they've had every so often they have a show there with some Hasidic theme.
What was the name of
the book?
They've
had one recently,
by the way, about the Hasidic idea in Israel. Is that the title?
No, the Messianic idea in Israel
idea.
By Klausner, Joseph Klausner. It came out There's an English translation of it done by, I forget the fellow's name of the translation, but it's well worth looking at. The last chapter, he takes like each chapter, each book of the Old Testament, and he brings out the messianic ideas that are in there, but the last chapter, it's called the messianic idea in Judaism and Christianity, and he contrasts like how the Christians have a mainly spiritual idea of the Messiah, salvation, sin, and all these things, which are very, he says they came in from other sources and things. He contrasts how the two ideas developed along very different pathways, that because they spiritualized the idea of the Messiah more. And the Jews said that it has to be salvation from this worldly domination to the nations. This the Messiah, the main thing is that Israel will be no longer under the dominion of the nations, that Israel will emerge as God's people in the world, chosen people in the world, and that they will no longer be under the rule of the nations. This is the essential. If he doesn't do this, then everything else is secondary. This talk of release from sin, he says, this is all very, very late and very strange. But the essential thing is that Messiah is a human figure who will bring about Israel's release from worldly bondage, worldly status or whatever. And this, if he doesn't do this, then other questions don't even arise. But this saving from sin and all this is on very, very poor authority. This is all very late. It's an interesting chapter.
I'll look for it.
I have the book at home. If I get a chance, I'll make a photocopy.
That would be great.
For you.
Well, we thank you very much, and I look forward to meeting the rest of the family.
Okay. Stop by anytime.